This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Secret to Southern Charm, a novel by Christy Woodson Harvey. Read by Janet Metzger and Candace Thaxton. 1. Home. Sloane. Time had lost its meaning. I only realized it was night because the water outside my bedroom window at my mother's home in Peachtree Bluff, Georgia, wasn't blue anymore. It was black and shining like fresh paved asphalt, but inside, in my room, on my TV, it wasn't night. It was Saturday morning, the third precious birthday of my son, Adam Jr., or AJ, as we called him. My strong, national hero of a husband in his off-duty khaki shorts and collared shirt was holding our other son, six-month-old Taylor, in one arm. I was behind the camera, cooing, "Smile for Daddy, one more time. Can you smile for Daddy?" Taylor smiled. Who wouldn't smile for the handsome man holding him? It was almost funny to see that 6'3" soldier with his big sculpted arms and huge hands made for protecting, holding that tiny baby. But Adam wasn't just a strong and loyal soldier. He was my husband. He was my boy's father. He was my home. His arms were the only place I had truly felt safe, special, and loved. His smile was the one that changed my life, had convinced me to marry, to have children, to put myself out there and love this big. His heart was the one that, after a decade of feeling so terrorized by my father's death, had made me feel safe again. Adam had changed absolutely everything. His dark hair, peppered with gray, was buzzed short. His kind brown eyes twinkled at me through the camera as he said,
"Three, Sloane. Can you believe he's three?"
We were in front of our townhouse on Post in North Carolina. Adam liked the idea of us being in a townhome, of having other families close by. He didn't say it, but he liked the idea of other families being close by because he wouldn't always be around. It was inevitable. He felt like we were safe here when he was away. The video panned over our house, a sweet Carolina blue with a front porch on a street, like all the streets on Post, named after a World War II battle campaign. My mother had decorated the generic four-bedroom interior, converting one of the bedrooms into a playroom and sparing no expense on the open floor plan living room, dining room, and kitchen downstairs. It was almost embarrassingly beautiful. We shared a driveway with my friend Mary Ann and her husband Tom, who was a part of Adam's unit, and their four kids. Tom called, "Hey, Sarge," and gave Adam a double thumbs up. We were all still basking in the glow of Adam's promotion to Sergeant First Class. There were a lot of perks that came with the job. But hands down, the perk that meant the most to Adam was the respect. The feeling of a job well done. Junior enlisted soldiers would come to him asking for advice, wanting his opinion. He always said he was raising men, and he didn't just mean his sons. Those boys were his now, even though he wasn't much older than some of them. It was his job to protect them, to instill in them morals, values, and a sense of pride in their country and in themselves. Adam was an imposing man. A strong leader, but he also had a kind heart. Maybe the Army didn't care about that, but I had to think his empathetic nature was a factor in his promotion. We loved living there, surrounded by other military families, the only ones who could truly understand the life we had chosen. Four of our favorite couples and their small children were scattered around our postage stamp front yard. Each of them, from the largest officer to Marianne's newborn baby, wearing a Mickey Mouse party hat. AJ was attempting to ride his new mini scooter through the grass, the red Keds and white John John with the red fire truck Mom had sent him for his birthday, seeming more than a little out of place amidst the other children in their shorts and t-shirts. My husband had protested the outfit, but I had simply kissed him and said, "Oh, sweetheart, he's only little once. Let me have this." Adam had pulled me to him then, kissed me longer, and said teasingly,
"If you get the girly outfits, I get buying him a BB gun for his 6th birthday."
This was a common joke between us. I was, ironically, very anti-gun. He was a soldier, a card-carrying member of the NRA, a proud Second Amendment supporter. We would never agree on this. We would never agree, in fact, on a number of things, but that's what made us work. Back on screen, we were all singing, "Happy birthday, dear AJ. Happy birthday to you." We cheered as it took him not one, not two, but 3 tries to blow out the 3 candles on his cake.
"Third time's the charm?"
Adam asked me, looking into the camera. We both laughed, sharing that private moment, my favorite man in all the world holding one of our sons, his arm around the other. Adam smiled into the camera, that special smile he reserved just for me, a secret we would never let the rest of the world in on. I hit pause on my sticky remote. Sticky from what? I couldn't say. Popsicle? Go-gurt? I pulled the 2 down comforters I had wrapped around me up closer to my chin, trying to soothe the perceptible chill that ran through me as my mind pulled out of that world, where Adam was here and we were happy, and back into the present, the real world, where life was bleak, empty, and so cold it felt like the depths of the Arctic instead of a 78-degree night in Georgia. My bed was covered with letters Adam had written me over the years, the ones I carried in a leather portfolio my mom had gotten me when I was accepted into art school. Whenever I traveled, it was the first thing that went into my suitcase. The trip to Peachtree had been no exception. A few of the letters fluttered when I disturbed the comforter. I glanced over at the nightstand to see my dinner untouched on its tray. My mom was trying, bless her heart. I almost smiled because nothing ever changed, not really. I did the same thing with my sons now, putting the broccoli on their plates even if I knew they wouldn't take a single bite. The mere thought of eating turned my stomach, made bile rise up the back of my throat. I couldn't remember the last time I'd even gotten out of this bed or had a sip of water. I certainly hadn't bathed in far too long. How long had it been since I heard Adam was MIA? 2 days? A week? A month? It terrified me. Who had been taking care of my children? Even if I couldn't eat, I would bathe tomorrow. I would face my boys. But this was something I thought every day. I looked back at the TV, studying Adam's smiling face, so joyful and alive. He was my home. He was my everything. I sank even deeper into the covers, and the sobs, so powerful they seemed like they were in danger of stealing the very life from me, overtook me as I realized it. I may never be home again.
2. Red Sky at Night, Ansley. The sun had nearly set when I sank into the plush cushion of the outdoor sofa on my front porch in Peachtree Bluff. Despite my exhaustion, anxiety, and sorrow, there was something about this porch and this particular sunset, a burning red and hot orange that always soothed my mind. My grandson Taylor's fever from the day before seemed to have finally broken, and I hoped beyond hope that AJ, snuggled safely in my bed instead of his own, wouldn't be woken again by nightmares. I looked down at the piles of sand on the front porch, the clumps that had fallen out when A.J. decided to strip off his bathing suit and run naked through the sprinklers, that little rascal. I smiled. That was the thing about children. All day the stinkers can drive you nuts, but the minute they're asleep, you want to gaze at them, drink them in, suppress the urge to wake them for one more cuddle, one more giggle, one more moment in time. "Do you think I should wake Taylor to give him more Tylenol before I go to bed?" I asked my mom. The thought made me cringe. There would be bribing, bargaining, and selling my soul. Taylor would whine and wriggle until I thought I would lose my mind and promise candy, a trip to the toy store, a pony, anything to make this stop. Then he would finally let me shoot the Tylenol in his mouth, take a sip of water, and reach out for the popsicle I would have ready to take the edge off the taste. I didn't want to do it, but I loved those grandbabies more than life. I looked beside me at Mom, awaiting her sage answer, and almost laughed. She could have been on a greeting card, dressed as she was in a floral zip-front housecoat, her hair tightly wrapped in the curlers she would sleep in, her pink satin bedroom slippers hugging her slender feet. Although the frequent Botox and touch-up sessions from her dermatologist in Florida would have indicated otherwise, Mom had been a fixture on this wide front porch, which originally belonged to her parents, for more than 80 years. I had replaced my grandmother's matching rockers with cozy teak chairs and a couch, small white Saarinen end tables, and a teak dining table and chairs on the opposite end. It was the best porch in the world, and I never wanted to leave. Maybe this was why my grandmother had left the house to me in her will. She knew how much I adored this home, that I was the only one capable of loving it as much as she did. "Darling," Mom said, pulling one of the sea-blue Serena and Lily herringbone throws off the back of the sofa and wrapping it around her shoulders. "If the child's fever spikes in the night, he will wake up. Good heavens, what do you think the pioneers did?" I laughed, sinking back into one of the new Dalmatian print throw pillows I had just gotten. They accentuated this sweeping white clapboard home, situated on the water a block from downtown, with the black shutters I had added after much ado, and digging up a photo from the late 1800s that proved to the Historical Association that there had once been shutters on the house. And as such, if I could copy them exactly, I could replace them. I could hear Emerson's and Caroline's voices wafting down from the uncovered upstairs porch with its 6 outdoor lounges perfect for sunbathing. My friend and handyman, Hippie Hal, had added a platform for yoga at the end of the porch outside the bay window of my bedroom, the largest of the 5 in the main house. I shook my head. "I don't know, Mom. I would have made a very poor pioneer." She looked at me seriously. "That you would, darling." In contrast to my mother, I was still wearing the tailored tan and white striped shirt dress I'd had on since I showered from my day at the beach with my rambunctious grandsons. Caroline had picked out this dress for me, and I absolutely loved it. It hit right at the knee and was cinched at the waist. It reminded me of an updated 1950s housewife frock, which, with the cooking, cleaning, and child-rearing, I basically was, minus the husband, of course. I wished I could be a little more like my mother, comfortable enough to be on my front porch in my bathrobe. But the tourists walking by from downtown deterred me. Had I said that to my mother, she would have replied, "It's your damn front porch. If you want to sit out here stark naked, you should." I pulled the cork out of the open bottle of rosé and poured just a splash, as Mom would say, into each of our oversized Riedel wine glasses. Her splash was more like a third of the bottle, but who was I to judge? The woman was old enough to make her own decisions, and she would. I took a sip, trying to dull the pain that While Emerson and Caroline were up there sharing the secrets of sisters, Sloane, my little wounded bird, was entrenched in the darkness of her room, in the pitch black of her new reality. I took a deep breath and felt a sob welling up within me, but I suppressed it. I looked into my mother's blue eyes, the same eyes I saw each time I looked at my own face in the mirror, and I could feel her strength, the strength I had always borrowed during the toughest moments of my life. These past few months with my girls back in Peachtree Bluff had been one of those hard times, one of those periods in their lives when, though I wanted to save them, protect them, shelter them, I couldn't. Yet again, the universe had delivered challenges for my grown daughters whom I had loved and wanted so much. Those children whom I had sacrificed for. Crossed that line between right and wrong quite a few times for. I could not erase the fact that Caroline's husband, James, had cheated on her with a supermodel, or that her son had been born in the midst of that. And I could not bring Sloane's husband, who was missing in action in Iraq, home. Quite a few times I had thought that at least Emerson, my youngest, was okay. But I sensed something was slightly askew with her, too. Maybe it was that, though she was filming her biggest movie to date, she hadn't quite found the acting success she had dreamed of. Maybe it was that she hadn't found the true love she dreamed of. Or maybe, I had to consider, that was only my wish for her. The reality was that I couldn't even handle my own love life, much less hers. So I sat on the front porch beside my mother, the person who made me feel perhaps the most complicated emotions of all, the one who, though I knew she loved me unconditionally, never felt the way about me that I do about my girls. Never felt the need to change it or fix it. She took a sip of her wine, and while she looked out over the water, the sunset making it nearly the same shade as her dark rosé, I looked at her. I wondered what was happening in her mind, what complicated firing of synapses was taking place to make her a little different these days. But breaking me out of my thoughts, she said, "Red sky at night, sailor's delight." It's something she had said to me countless times throughout my life, but this time I felt slow tears rolling down my cheeks. Adam loved to fish, and this red sky would have meant that, in the morning, offshore conditions would be perfect. It was an ordinary phrase. Yet for my daughter nothing was ordinary, nothing was right. Sloane's entire life had been turned upside down in one moment. I thought, unfairly, cruelly, that this was Adam's fault. He had always wanted to be more than a husband and a father. Why couldn't that be enough for him? Why couldn't he have a normal job with regular hours that let him get back home to his young family? Mom squeezed the top of my arm, but didn't say a word. What was there to say? "What do I do?" I whispered. She shook her head. "You can't fix this for her, Ansley." I shrugged. "I know that, but I can't even get her out of bed." I paused and took a deep breath. I didn't want to say it out loud, but I had to. "It has been almost 3 weeks, Mom. I'm afraid if she doesn't get out of that bed now, she never will." I had spent countless hours Googling depression, calling doctor friends, and buying books that, due to my status as grandmother turned primary caregiver for two toddlers, had sat practically untouched on my bedside table. But the reality remained. I had already learned about depression in the worst way, which might also be the best way. First-hand experience. I knew what it was like to find out your husband was dead, that you were the only one left to fight for your family. But Sloane wasn't there, not yet. She needed help. But how could I help someone who didn't want it? Caroline, Emerson, and I had been entertaining Sloane's boys constantly, trying to distract them from the fact that the only time they saw their mother was when they crawled into bed with her. She would smile at them blankly without even seeing them, and stare back at the TV screen where home videos of her and Adam with the boys were playing on a continuous loop night and day. We were doing the best we could, but they wanted their mother. Taylor cried for her 5 or 6 times a day, and it broke my heart. AJ was acting out, throwing toys and tantrums over nothing, pinching Taylor. We were doing all we could for them, but I felt fairly certain these boys had lost their father. They couldn't lose their mother, too. My mom shook her head again. "I'm proud of you," she said. "I'm proud of how you've stepped up." Though she had said nothing that could possibly help me in this impossible situation, as she took my hand, I felt calmer. It was, as it always had been, my mother who gave me this incredible strength and inner peace, my mother who lent me fortitude when I needed it most. It was then that I realized it. Sometimes, being a mother isn't about having to fix it. Sometimes, the best thing a mother can be is there at all.
3. The Light. Sloane. June 16th, 2010.
Dear Sloane, I will be home in 10 days. 10 days until I get to hold you and kiss you and make you my wife. 10 days until we get to stand in front of our family and friends and say how much we love each other. How we fell in love in this most unusual way that we will both cherish for the rest of our lives. I don't know how you've done all this while I was away. Planned this entire wedding for me, but for us. I am so grateful to you, my beautiful girl. And I'm the luckiest man alive that I get to spend the rest of my life proving it to you. All my love, Adam.
June 16th, 2017. Get up! I vaguely heard Caroline's voice breaking through my dream, where Adam and I were driving down the road, singing to the radio on the way to our favorite hotel in the North Carolina mountains. A small bed and breakfast in downtown Blowin' Rock that had a fireplace in every room and amazingly reasonable off-season rates. His parents knew how much we loved it, and every Christmas they gave us a gift certificate for 2 nights at the hotel and 2 nights of their expert child care services. It was my favorite gift. "You've been wallowing in here for 34 days, Caroline said. "And you kind of stink." Ah, yes, Caroline. Always the tactful one. I opened one eye, and it all came flooding back to me. Adam wasn't in the car beside me. Adam wasn't in the North Carolina mountains. Adam was gone. Adam was lost, somewhere in the Middle East, somewhere I couldn't find him. My heart began to race with panic. My sister threw open the curtains, and I thought I might go blind from the harsh brightness. How had I ever relished the feel of the sun on my skin or lain in it to warm my body? I wanted to tell Caroline to close the curtains. Then it hit me. Was Adam in the sun? Was he being scorched alive by the very thing that was supposed to give him life? It had been 34 days since those uniformed men came to tell me my Adam was missing in action. My mind filled only with terror and dread, worst-case scenarios that pinged day and night like a loose ball on a racquetball court. The death didn't scare me. The torture did. The starvation. The pain. The indignity. For years, ever since the night we met, only 3 weeks before his deployment, I imagined I could feel Adam. that my heart was connected to his the way the moon is connected to the tide. That connection controlled our world. Looking back on those 34 days, I don't remember my son's laughter. I don't remember them snuggling in bed with me. I don't remember my sisters taking turns sleeping with me, my mother feeding me, my grandmother singing to me. It is as though my mind is a bloody crime scene that has been wiped meticulously clean. The only thing I can recall from all those days is my memories of the past, my videos of the happy times, my letters from Adam. Day 34. And still, every time my bedroom door opened, I felt a jolting panic that someone was going to tell me he was gone. My mom had come in just before Caroline and paused my video, which terrified me at first, but I was too weak and exhausted to protest. "Darling," she said, "time to get up. The boys are having a very hard time without you. If we need to get you to a doctor or on some sort of medication, we can and we will, but you have to get out of bed." I thought of my children. I felt like I was crumbling from the inside out. I loved them. I needed them. They needed me, but I was so numb. My heart, a desolate desert where nothing could live, nothing could grow. My children were better off without me. When I didn't say anything, Mom left, but now Caroline was here playing bad cop to Mom's good cop. It was a pretty proven strategy, but it wasn't going to work on me. It was clear they had decided today was the day for the intervention, but I wasn't ready to be intervened upon, so it didn't much matter. Caroline lay down beside me in bed, but abruptly got up and moved to the chair. She had forgotten how badly I stunk. If you stink too badly for even your sister to lie beside you, that's a problem. She crossed her arms. "Sloane, you are neglecting your children, and quite frankly, you're neglecting me." I think she was trying to be funny, but I was past the point of finding anything funny. "Your kids need you, Sloane. They're miserable and angry, and they don't understand what's happening. It's your job to be there for them." I was used to Caroline's insults, her judgment, and her harshness. I braced myself for what she would say next, so when she took a deep breath, softened, composed herself, and said, "Sweetie, I want to read you this essay Vivi wrote for school." It was actually worse. If she had yelled at me or told me I was being selfish, I could have taken it. But her sympathy meant I was even worse off than I had thought. Changing her tactic from forceful to soft meant something was shifting between us. I didn't like that. "It's titled My Hero." She cleared her throat, and I knew this essay was about her Uncle Adam, her hero. I wasn't sure I could take it, but I knew how she felt. He was my hero, too. So it caught me off guard when Caroline read, "My Aunt Sloane is my hero. Her husband, my Uncle Adam, is a sergeant first class in the Army, which means he fights hard for our country and goes on special missions that no one else can do. When he has gone fighting, my Aunt Sloane goes on special missions, too. She takes care of my cousins, AJ and Taylor, all by herself. She even homeschools them. They are really smart. AJ can already read, and even little Taylor knows his alphabet. She cooks all their meals and sings lots of songs, and she always remembers to buy me a birthday present, even when she's really busy. She calls my mom every day to make sure we are okay, so we always remember how much she loves us. My Aunt Sloane prays hard to God every day to keep my Uncle Adam safe. That's how I know he is okay, even though he is missing in action in Iraq because his helicopter crashed and he was captured by insurgents. Everyone is worried, but I know he is okay because my Aunt Sloane knows he is okay because she prays about Uncle Adam every day. She prays hard, and she works hard, and she loves her family and is the best mom. That's why my Aunt Sloane is my hero." I'm not sure when I started crying, but I felt something shift in me when Caroline read my 11-year-old niece's words, that I knew her Uncle Adam was okay because I prayed for him every day. Was that true? Did I know? I wasn't sure of anything anymore. "It's amazing, isn't it?" Caroline said. I nodded. I wanted to say something. I wanted to thank her or tell her to hug Vivi for me, but my mouth wouldn't work. So instead, I let her feed me a little chicken soup. I didn't want it, but I didn't want to feel this way anymore, either. That was progress, I thought. "I would kiss you," Caroline said, "but you smell worse than the crab pots on the dock." As Caroline was feeding me, AJ burst through the door, my mom on his heels, with so much energy that I felt even more tired. "Mommy, Mommy," he said urgently. "Mommy, I've got to ask you a question," he said, peering up into my face from the floor below. Caroline smiled at him, a laugh in her throat. "Is Daddy dead?" I froze, the few bites of soup I'd eaten growing heavy in my stomach. "Oh, honey," Mom said, taking his shoulders gently and saying, "let's go play while Mommy finishes lunch." "Is he, Mommy? Because Billy down the street says Daddy is dead." I felt something stir inside me, something that felt a little like fight, a little like hope. "No," I eked out, my voice sounding rough and rusty, like a screened door that hasn't been opened in far too long. "No, sweet boy, of course Daddy isn't dead." It was then that I realized I believed it. I believed my husband was alive. "Oh, good," AJ said, his voice laden with relief. "Because he's going to get me a BB gun for my 6th birthday." Mom and Caroline chuckled, and I almost smiled. Almost. The simplicity of children. The wonder of it all was one of the great joys of life. I had forgotten that. It wasn't until after they had left, until after I hit play again, that I realized Mom had set up an easel in the corner of the room with a single canvas, a paintbrush, some paint, and a small palette. But I didn't paint anymore, and she certainly wasn't going to get me to paint now. I looked back at the screen where Adam was talking, videoing me as I gave AJ his first bath. Then I looked back at the easel. There was something about it that seemed inviting, that tugged me toward it. I tried to sit up. My eyes got starry and everything went black. I persevered, though, putting one foot on the ground and then the other. I held on to the wall as everything went black again. With my past flashing on the screen beside me, I picked up that brush. I don't know how long I sat there, but when I looked at what I'd created, I felt a little better. It was an abstract piece of blacks and grays with hints of silver. As I examined my work, something inside me felt a little lighter, a little less closed off. As if maybe the world as I knew it wasn't ending. Maybe. My little sister Emerson came through the doorway quietly. She was the tall one, the most beautiful one, the nearly famous one. Even still, Caroline and I both felt the need to protect her. There was such an innocence to her, even at 26. We couldn't help but want to shelter her. She stood beside me, studying the painting, and said, "It's sad. But it's beautiful." "Thanks," I whispered, realizing there was paint all over me. I set the brush down on the palette. Emerson took my hand and said, "Come on, sweetie. Let me get you into the bath." Was this what my life had come to? People had to bathe me now? I thought of my grandmother downstairs who had come to live with us, whom my mom was taking care of. My grandmother. Caroline and her 2 kids, Emerson, my own 2 kids. It had started out as so much fun, all of us in the same house, playing and laughing. That was me then. The me I was now couldn't imagine ever smiling again, ever laughing again, ever...
Adam, oh, Adam, where was he? What was happening to him? Would I ever know? It was September 11th, all over again, knowing my dad was in that tower, knowing it had fallen, not knowing if he was alive, but feeling certain I would never see him again. I believed I knew what my mom went through in the wake of my dad's death. I felt like I understood her, that losing your father had to be equivalent to losing the love of your life, but I hadn't. Not really. Not until now. I remember overhearing my mom telling her friends it still haunted her that she couldn't remember telling my dad goodbye. That she couldn't remember if she had kissed him before he left that day, that between packing lunches, making sure Emerson had her costume for her play, signing my permission slip, and telling Caroline she had on too much makeup, she couldn't remember if she told him she loved him. At the time, I thought that was silly. He was dead. We would never see him again. Who cared if she had kissed him goodbye? But now I understood. All I could think about was what I said the last time I had talked to Adam, what I wished I had done differently. It wasn't a good feeling. I heard the water running, and I let Emerson help me to the bathroom. I couldn't believe how devoid of energy I felt, as if every ounce of the person I had been was running out of me like the bathwater down the drain. As Emerson helped me with my shirt, I realized I wouldn't have been able to do this without her. I glanced at the mirror and didn't recognize myself. My face was gray and drawn, making my brown eyes hollow. I'd been worried about losing the last 10 pounds of baby weight. Now my skin was taut over my ribs and belly. I lowered myself into the tub, allowing the water to cover my face. I opened my eyes under the water and watched the bubbles coming out of my nose, the light from the chandelier above me wiggling and distorted. For a moment I considered not coming back up for air. I could let the water take me away where I wouldn't have to feel or think or fear anymore. I could just leave. Quietly, without a struggle. As my lungs grew hot, I heard an echoed, far away, "Mommy?" If I didn't take that next breath, my children would be all alone. I lifted my head out of the water, gasping for air. Taylor, my 20-month-old, laughed at the sight of me.
"Mommy,"
he said again with glee.
"Mommy, mommy, mommy."
He leaned his face over the tub and planted a sticky kiss on my cheek, wrapping his warm arms around my wet neck. I remembered Vivi's essay. I remembered I was someone's hero. I'd promised Adam, had vowed to him that when he was away, I would be here, raising our babies and continuing our life. It was my job as a military wife to make good on that promise. This was my role, the one I had chosen. Or maybe it had chosen me. It was hard to tell now. I closed my eyes and saw my painting again. I felt its strength. I thought of Vivi again, of her belief in me. I believed in Adam. It was going to be okay. It would be easier to retreat back into my cocoon of memories, my home videos, my letters, my sorrow. But Caroline was right. Mom was right. Emerson was right. I had my boys to live for. I had to carry on. Instead of succumbing to the dark, if I was ever going to come out of this, I had no choice but to look for the light. My son's blue eyes were a perfect start.
4. Transitional. Ansley. When I opened the door to the store that morning, the first thing I did was rush to my store manager-turned-design assistant, Leah, and hug her. Her strawberry blonde hair was pulled up in a tight ponytail, and she was wearing an emerald green silk blouse, the exact color of her eyes. The dusting of freckles across her nose had become more prominent this summer. I looked around. Everything seemed pretty much the same, despite my almost total absence over the past month. The living room display set up at the front of the shop, the tables of accessories, the shelves of books and candles. The only thing better than the inside was the gorgeous view out the window of the waterfront. And I never took for granted that work was a 2-block walk from home. It was the best commute I knew of. She laughed. What was that for? I shook my head. What was it not for? You have run my entire life for more than a month, Leah. There aren't enough thank yous. She waved me away like it was nothing. And before I could say anything else, she asked, Any thoughts on those ceilings at the Turner House? But it wasn't nothing. That she had taken over like this said a lot about her future at the store, her future with me, and made me realize that I needed to give her a raise. The Turners had just bought the house at the end of my street. It was surrounded by water on three sides and, built in the mid-1700s, was one of the oldest white clapboard houses in town. That, of course, posed a few design challenges. But if there was anything I loved, it was a challenge. Admittedly, I had a few more than I wanted coming at me these days, but I could handle one more if it meant figuring out how to make 7.5-foot ceilings seem taller and make tiny rooms feel more spacious. I nodded. I've been going back and forth, but I think we need to rip them out like we did in the kitchen. Let's stain the exposed rafters to give them a beam-like feel and lacquer the shiplap between them. It will give them a few more inches of height. I paused. And we'll add so much character. She smiled. I love that, and we are so on the same page. I was thinking about going a little bit transitional, adding some modern flair. This was why I loved Leah. She got me. Yes, I said excitedly. It's never going to be a grand home, no matter what we do. So I say we mix key antiques with new upholstery and some unexpected accessories. Leah nodded and handed me the mood board she'd been working on. Faye loves gold, so what about these? The Barbara Cosgrove jar lamps with gold stripes and gold shades would be a perfect fun touch on the pair of antique demi-lune commodes we were using underneath a pair of windows in the living room. Let's mix natural fiber rugs with those great antique Persian ones they have. Leah nodded and made a note. The ones with the blues, right? The greens aren't going to work. Exactly, I said, walking toward the back of the store to check out the boxes waiting there for me. This was the best thing about having a store. You got presents every day. Oh, and Leah, I called. I want one of us to be there every day during construction. We need to make sure the original floors, moldings, window casings, and those amazing pocket doors are properly restored. She nodded, standing beside me now. Do you want them burned back to the original? I thought for a second. Only in the rooms with the egg and dart. The bell on the door tinkled, and my mouth started watering before I even turned around.
As I live and breathe, if it isn't Ainsley Murphy in her store.
I turned to smile at Kyle with his tanned limbs, sun-kissed hair, and perfectly chiseled jawline. To be clear, I was drooling over the coffee he was delivering. I'd leave the drooling over Kyle to the younger generation. Can you even believe it? I asked. Kyle was beside me now. I turned and he kissed me on the cheek.
Our girl looks a little better, he said.
I smiled. She's a mess, but she's out of bed. I shrugged.
I'll take it.
He handed me my cup. What is it? I asked.
I felt like you needed comfort and stability, so I went back to your old favorite. Skinny vanilla soy latte.
I was a little hurt when he didn't add, but you don't need the skinny, like he usually did.
I know Sloane loves chocolate milk, Kyle continued, so I made her some with a bit of ashwagandha to relieve her stress. It's amazing if I do say so myself.
I held my breath as I asked,
Did she drink it? He smiled and nodded, satisfied. Leah, he said as she panted over, iced coconut chai latte for you, my friend.
Thanks, Kyle, she said breathlessly. She took a sip. It's so good.
Kyle turned back to me and winked. He knew what he did to these poor girls. To my knowledge, he hadn't been romantically connected to anyone in at least 6 months. That seemed unusual for him. The door tinkled again, and to my surprise, it was Kimmy, Peachtree Bluff's resident produce girl. I hadn't seen her in a couple of weeks, and she looked different. Her previously spiky half-blue hair was longer and all black again. It was softer, cute. Cuffs with diamonds traveled up her ears, and a tiny diamond stud twinkled in her nose. Oh, good, Kyle said. You're here. I looked from one to the other, trying to assess what they were up to.
We're making you dinner tomorrow night, Kimmy said.
I put my hand to my heart. What? Kyle nodded.
Yes, Chef Kimmy and I are making dinner for all the Murphy women.
And the two tiny men, Kimmy added.
You don't have to do that, I said, flattered.
Of course we do, Kimmy said.
We love you, Ansley, Kyle agreed. Now that Sloane is out of bed, let's give her a reason to stay out. Let's celebrate a little.
You sweet, darling children, I accept your very kind offer. Kimmy grabbed a cup out of the insulated Coke crate-turned coffee carrier that was hanging by a leather guitar strap around Kyle's neck. She tapped her cup to mine.
It wasn't an offer, she said. We were doing it whether you liked it or not.
It was one of those times that made me remember why I lived in Peachtree Bluff, why this town meant so much to me. These small kindnesses might not have seemed like much. But at times like these, small kindnesses were actually everything. When I got back home that afternoon, Mom and Caroline were chatting on the white linen living room couch while Caroline fed Preston a bottle. The house seemed quiet. Too quiet.
Where is everyone? I asked.
Emerson convinced Sloane to take the boys out in the wagon, Caroline said, adjusting the swaddle blanket on her shoulder that covered part of the sleeveless white blouse she had paired with perfectly fitted black shorts. It was simple, but on Caroline, impossibly chic.
Vivi is riding her bike with them.
My eyes widened. I was impressed. That's major. Mom exhaled and put a hand up to the opera-length pearls that hung over a simple pink long-sleeved shift. Looking at the two of them side by side, it was easy to see where Caroline got her style.
Y'all need to stop babying her. If you keep doing everything for her, you're just going to make her worse.
Caroline smiled down at Preston as she said, I feel so sorry for her. Even I'm having a hard time doling out the tough love. I sat down in one of the club chairs across from Mom and Caroline. I think we're even more sympathetic because we've all lived what she's living, not being sure if someone you love more than life is dead.
Oh, I don't think she thinks he's dead, Mom said.
Well, she knows he's in a horrible situation.
Right, Mom said. She's in a horrible situation. He's in a horrible situation. And you're all complicit in letting her wallow in it.
Caroline sat Preston up on her lap, leaning his chin into her hand, and patted his back to coax out a burp.
No, we're not, she said. Not anymore.
And it worked, didn't it? Mom asked.
This conversation was making me uncomfortable and a little bit angry.
Sure, Mom hadn't let me come home or helped me in any way after my husband Carter died. And yes, it turned out okay. But that didn't mean that's what I needed to do with Sloan. I loved my mother and I respected her, but freezing me out like that when I needed someone to lean on had nearly killed me. I wasn't going to put my daughter through that. Kimmy and Kyle are making dinner for us tomorrow night, I said, changing the subject as the door slammed. They are? Emerson asked. That's so nice. Sloan trailed in behind her, Taylor on her hip. His head was resting on her shoulder, and I could almost feel his bliss at having his mother back. Sloan was so thin that her little shorts were hanging off her hips. Her light brown hair was ratty and pulled back into a slouchy ponytail. The circles under her doe eyes had circles. Usually Sloan had rosy cheeks, clear skin, and that sort of natural, effortless beauty reserved for Neutrogena commercials. Now she was so pale and sallow, her normally full cheeks sunken in. I hardly recognized her. I wished I could hold her and make it better like she was doing for Taylor. I want some more of that chocolate milk, Sloan said, exhausted. If you want chocolate milk, then you shall have chocolate milk. I could hear Vivi and AJ laughing and yelling out on the lawn. Is this dinner a family thing? Emerson asked. She leaned casually against the wall, her leggings and tank accentuating her lithe body. She was eating well again, off that dreadful juice cleanse she had been on when she got to Peachtree Bluff. But her legs and arms still looked too thin to me. And she was a bit pale, too, which was odd, considering she was getting plenty of June sunshine. I cocked my head to the side. Well, no, I suppose not. Did you want to invite some friends? She took a sip out of the water bottle in her hand as she strode across the room and said, No friends. I just thought I'd ask Mark. And she was gone before we could ask her any questions, that smart girl. Well, that's new, I said. Not as new as you might think, Caroline said. You know, Mom, you should really get better control over your household. Mom laughed heartily. I looked at Sloan, hoping for a smile, but her face was as stone cold as ever. I've always liked Mark, Mom said, and it's time for Emerson to settle down. Let's not get ahead of ourselves, Mom, I said. It's just dinner. Dinner with the entire family, Sloan pointed out, sharing a look with her sister. That was true. I liked Mark, and I loved the idea of Emerson settling down. I didn't disapprove of her laser focus on her career, but I wanted her to have other things, too. I wanted her to have more.
Mommy, I thirsty,
Taylor said. I can get him something to drink, Caroline said, though she was still burping Preston. It's okay, Sloan said, walking toward the kitchen.
See? Coddling, Mom said. I rolled my eyes. I couldn't do this with her. Not today.
Hey, Mom, Caroline said. I'm going to put Preston down for his nap. Do you mind listening for him? I'm going to take Grammy out to lunch. Caroline winked at Mom, and she winked back. Those two were always up to something. I wished Mom could be a tiny bit better at disguising the fact that Caroline was her favorite.
That's fine, I said, my mind still on Sloan. I'm going to go make some tea, I said, getting up and heading to the kitchen.
It was terribly transparent, but if I wanted to help my daughter, then that was my prerogative. As I reached my arms out to take Taylor from Sloan, as exhausted as I had been, I missed the boys like crazy while I was at work.
I glanced out the window at the house next door that once belonged to Mr. Solomon, my crazy neighbor whom I had fought with for years over the fence that separated our yards. Happily, we made up in the weeks before his death, thanks to Caroline of all people. Now it sat empty and alone, almost sullen, as if it were reaching out to me. It wasn't as large or grand as this house, but it had a charm that had always drawn me in. I wondered for the millionth time who would scoop it up when it went on the market, and how I would convince the buyers to let me decorate it. And for a split second, Jack, the first boy I had ever told how much I loved that house, crossed my mind. But he was gone, I remembered. And so were those sunny, carefree summer days.
5. Enlisted. Sloan. June 18th, 2013.
Dear Sloan, I can't express how painful it was to leave you and AJ today. There's a huge hole in my heart, a piece of me missing without the two of you. I felt like I couldn't breathe as I walked away from you, and now as I sit here, awake in the middle of the night, writing to you, I feel that pain again. Thank you for being the mother and woman you are, for taking care of our son when I can't, for loving both of us in the way you do. Already counting down the days until you are both in my arms again. All my love, Adam.
There's nothing like watching your husband board a plane to the Middle East to make you realize that you have absolutely no idea how to be a mother. The first 3 weeks with AJ had been tough, sure, but Mom had been there the first week and Adam had been so hands-on the second two that I hadn't truly realized how difficult it would be. Mom was in New York because it was Grandparents' Day at Vivi's school. Caroline was having such a tough time, her life revolving around hormone injections and IVF, that I felt almost guilty breathing in the sweet-smelling, perfectly pink head of my brand-new baby boy. Emerson was in L.A., Grammy was in Florida, my mother-in-law had just had a knee replacement, and my best and only real friend on post in North Carolina had just been stationed in California. That night with AJ had been the worst one by far. He wanted to feed every hour and a half and screamed in between. My nipples were raw and bleeding, and I was pretty sure I had a UTI, but my doctor didn't want me to take an antibiotic. Every square inch of my house was filled with some sort of baby apparatus, and the trash cans were filled with dirty diapers that I hadn't yet found the time or energy to take out. AJ was screaming, and to keep from throwing him out the window, I did the unthinkable. The thing my pediatrician had harped on like it was life or death, I turned on the TV. I was sure social services would sense I had broken the primary rule of parenting and arrive at my door any minute, but almost instantly, AJ quit crying. I was so tired I couldn't even feel the overwhelming mom guilt. I lay down on the floor right beside his bouncy seat and closed my eyes. If I couldn't nap just for a few minutes, I was sure I would die. I was roused from my sleep by the feeling that someone was watching me. When I drowsily opened my eyes, I saw a protruding pregnant belly, and then I saw the woman it belonged to. I screamed and lunged for AJ, who looked at me curiously. All she said was, "First baby, huh?" I didn't respond. I looked up at her face, her mousy brown hair cut to her chin, a Cindy Crawford mole above her lip. She wasn't wearing any makeup and had on a simple, hot pink cotton maternity dress that tied in the back. She wasn't beautiful, but she was cute. Probably not a murderer or kidnapper, but better safe than sorry. "Sorry," she said. "I'm Marianne. I'm your new neighbor. Your back door was standing open, and I just wanted to make sure you were okay." My breathing slowed and I felt my pulse return to normal. Oh gosh, I said, finally waking up enough to figure out what was happening. I looked around, mortified. I'm so embarrassed. Please forgive the mess. I promise I'm not usually like this. She held out her hand and I let her pull me up.
You don't have to apologize to me, honey. I feel